Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for September 14th, 2014. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
Yes, join us for the first time on the show, welcome Jeff Singer.
Thanks, great to be on.
Yeah. Good to have you on. I'll give a little bit of background about Jeff and how he got here with us. David Neer, who's being on the Kudzu Vine as a guest from Daily Kudzu Elections, and I believe even back to Swing State Project days, hadn't been on in a while. We asked him to come on, and he said he couldn't make it this week, but he knew that Daily Kudzu Elections probably be good to have a presence on the Kudzu Vine, and so he recommended Jeff Singer, and I said, if you're good enough for David, you're good enough for us. So Jeff, you got not only your own expectations, but David Neer's as well coming onto the show.
Yeah, it's high expectations. So playing to meet them.
Yes. Well, now start off. So folks probably have read you on Daily Kudzu Elections. I mean, I clicked on the front page, which I click on throughout the week. It's just one of the many sources I use to do research for the show, and I saw your name on several posts right there on the front page, so I can tell you're one of the more frequent guys, but how did you get involved in politics, and where have you blogged, and different things like that?
Okay, so I've been involved in politics since I really started in college when I went to Tulane University here in New Orleans. I eventually was in charge of our Tulane College Democrats chapter, and in Louisiana, we've had our ups and downs, a bunch of downs in the last few cycles, but we held firm. And since I graduated from Tulane, I've still been in New Orleans. I've been with Daily Kudzu part-time-ish for about a year, and I started full-time recently. What I've mostly done for the election subsite is calculate how well Obama and Romney did in every state legislative chamber, where about to release a few more this week for what we call our President by LD project, including we're going to actually be rolling out maps and statistics in Louisiana and Arkansas this week. And that will give us most of them. And I've also been keeping track of ads, mayor races, polls, you name it.
Yeah,
and
I remain based
in New Orleans. I'm not originally from here, but I'm here now and happy to be here.
Oh, yeah. Well, now you mentioned a project you're doing for Daily Kudzu Elections with legislatures and the presidential candidates. Explain to our listeners a little bit more about that.
Okay. So what has been happening for a long time is we and other publications, we take a look at the last presidential results and try to calculate how well the presidential candidates did in every congressional district. So that way we could say, if we're looking at a congressional district, say, oh, Obama got 54% there, Romney got 46, something like that. And we decided last year to try doing this for state legislative chambers for the first time. This is, to my knowledge, never been done before nationwide by anybody, and we've been at it. So we're looking at every state legislative district in every state and calculating Obama and Romney's performances there, as well as other 2012 statewide candidates. So for a state like, say, that's a good example, for, say, Virginia, we not only looked at how well Obama did in every state Senate district, we also looked at how well Tim Kaine did and how well George Allen did. And we don't just do Senate president. We've done the governorships that have been up in, even some lower offices like state treasurer, attorney general, public service commissioner. If it's statewide, we'll get it.
Yeah, so I guess you're kind of, you know, the cutting edge trying to see which state Senate and state House districts are about to flip, correct?
Yeah, that's what we're looking at. And we want to see maybe what Republican incumbents are sitting in light blue districts who could use a challenge, or what Democrats might need protected. Or if we're looking at recruiting, maybe what Democrat has been able to win really, do really well in a red district and might be able to take their that show on the road statewide.
Yeah, well, that's really interesting work. I have a feeling we could just have you on for, you know, most of the hour and just ask about different states and different districts, but that might get mundane for our listeners, so we won't let us do that. I will reserve the right for Catherine if she wants to ask about any districts in Georgia, since that's near to dear in our heart. And probably that's our – we have listenership throughout the country and region, but I think plurality, at least, of our listeners come from Georgia. But, Catherine, you know, we've had Jeff on to ask him about all kind of different races throughout the South. He's obviously in Louisiana now. I'll let you have the first question.
That Louisiana Senate race is really, you know, back and forth, isn't it?
Yep. It's been pretty volatile, and there hasn't been as much polling in Louisiana as we'd like. Where public policy polling is supposed to release a new poll out in the next few days, so we'll have a better idea of how things are. But compared to states like Arkansas or Georgia or Kentucky, Louisiana just doesn't get as much polling love as it should.
And why do you think that is?
I'm not really sure. I think maybe part of it is the runoff. If no candidate gets 50% or more in the November general, the top two candidates advance to a runoff, and I think that has some national pollsters a little spooked. They're not sure they really want to wade into that and wade into all the complexities there. But I'm not entirely sure what states get polled more than others. Sometimes there are local groups or local universities that like to poll, but sometimes it just seems that's just how it is.
It's just sort of random, or the reasons are unknown to us, maybe.
Yeah, or there's somebody really well-known like Mitch McConnell, and so everyone wants to pile on and just say, hey, look, here's how McConnell's doing. You know him.
Right. Or states that are getting a lot of attention. You know, Georgia, for the first time since I've been participating in politics as much as I am, is getting a lot of attention this year. Of course, we had the First Lady was here this week, and President Clinton was here last night. So we're getting a lot of attention. So I think that's part of the reason why we're getting a lot of polls. You know, I think it's just – sort of the way it is. Well, what's your sense of Louisiana? Do you have a sense?
At the moment, I hate to say this, but I'd say I'm cautiously pessimistic. Some of the polls I've seen have shown Mary Landrieu, she's doing okay in a head-to-head matchup against Bill Cassidy, but the big problem is her favorables have not been good. They've been as much as 10 points underwater in some of the polls I've seen. And if you're a red state Democrat and you're unpopular, your only real hope is to make your opponent even more unpopular. And Democrats are definitely working to savage Cassidy, but I haven't gotten the sense that he's as radioactive as, say, Tom Cotton is in Arkansas or Mitch McConnell is in Kentucky. We'll know a little bit more when we get that new public policy polling this week, so hopefully I'm wrong. But if Mary Landrieu isn't holding her head above water and she's unpopular right now, it's probably only going to get it worse.
And is there a third candidate?
There are actually several candidates on the ballot, both Democrats, Republicans, a few independents. The main third candidate, though, is Republican Rob Manis. He is a former Air Force colonel, and he is a Tea Party activist. So what's expected to happen is he's going to take some votes away from Cassidy in November. The problem is he probably won't take enough to actually keep Cassidy from getting second or first place. So what's most likely to happen is still Landrieu and Cassidy advance to December to the runoff there.
And it's in December?
The runoff is in December, yes.
Oh.
If there is one. It's not completely out of the realm of possibility that Mary Landrieu could take 50% in November and win outright. But that's going to be very difficult. I'm hoping it happens, and I'm going to work to try to get us over there. But it's going to be difficult.
Yeah, because runoffs are bad for Democrats, generally.
Runoffs, yeah. Louisiana Democrats do at least seem to be a bit more accustomed to them than a lot of Democrats in other states, maybe just because it's been Louisiana has been doing it for so long, so voters are maybe a bit more in tune with the calendar. And Mary Landrieu did win a runoff in 2002 that many people expected her to lose in, so there is still hope there. But November
okay.
would be ideal.
Yeah, it's the runoffs, they're expensive and they're time-consuming, and everybody's already exhausted. So
yeah, and
it's not good.
And probably a nightmare scenario might be if at the end of November, if we get into a December runoff, if, say, 99 of the Senate seats, we know how it is, who's won, and it's, say, 50 Republicans, 49 Democrats, and Louisiana's the deciding factor, then it's going to be hard to ask voters, yes, hand the Senate over to the Democrats. Right now, we could make the argument, give it to Mary Landrieu. She's worked hard. She deserves it. But if the question becomes straight up, do you want the Republicans or the Democrats controlling the Senate, it's going to be a hard argument to make in Louisiana to say Democrats.
I see what you're saying. If it's part of a bigger picture, it's not quite so difficult. I get that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
David, you want to go next?
Yeah. Louisiana's probably a southern state that's really gone through, I guess, more transition than any others in, say, the last 10 years, and I think a lot of that's Hurricane Katrina. But, Democrats actually could compete at the presidential level in the Clinton elections in 92 and 96, and Mary Landrieu came into office in one of those elections. You had Bennett Johnson, Democratic governors, and all these different things. And just in the last, 5 to 10 years, it seems like the Republicans have really swept through, Bobby Jindal and David Vitter. I mean, it doesn't matter, seemingly matter what he does. He won re-election over a really good candidate in Congressman Malasaw. Mary Landrieu is that last Democrat that can really hang on. You're on the ground there. What's really going on in the state of Louisiana?
I think the biggest thing is Obama's not well-liked here at all, and Republicans are doing their best to make voters who might have voted for Landrieu in the past but don't like Obama see a vote for Landrieu is a vote for Obama, and that's really hard to overcome. Landrieu has been doing her best to emphasize how important she is to the state. She is the chairman of the Energy Committee, and that is vital in a big oil state like Louisiana. And Democrats have also been hammering Cassidy on his various issues. They've been attacking on the minimum wage or Social Security or veterans issues, and that's been a big formula that Democrats have used against Republicans in the South especially. So what you have is really Democrats are trying to argue both Landrieu's too important to lose and Cassidy's nuts, but while Republicans have a straight up, if you hate Obama, hate Landrieu.
Yeah, it just seems kind of strange in that, Hurricane Katrina was under the Bush administration. Obviously, they had no control over the weather, to be fair. But the response to it, they hesitated would be the nicest term you could put it in. And then you have the BP oil crisis, which, pretty much every poll says Democrats are seen as better protectors of the environment. These two major issues happened to Louisiana, and they're really better for the Democrats than they are the Republicans. Why are these two issues really not seemingly made any headway?
Well, for BP, one big issue is when the oil spill happens, the Obama administration decided to have a moratorium on drilling for a little while to make sure that things were safe. And well, that might sound good to Louisiana towns that relied so much on drilling. That was toxic. And Republicans began arguing Obama's trying to kill our economy. It's some sort of the same thing you might see in Kentucky and West Virginia, where Republicans are screaming war on coal, Obama wants to destroy us. Republicans here did that for oil. And Obama was already unpopular, so it wasn't hard to convince them, this guy you hate, he hates you. As for Katrina, I'm not part of that might have been our Democratic governor at the time, Kathleen Blanco, she was not perceived as doing a good job during the crisis at all. And that might have mitigated some of the partisan blame that Bush might have gotten.
Yeah, because obviously no politician came to that looking very good. Ray Nagin, probably the worst. And then Governor Blanco and then President Bush, none of the three really were seen as big heroes out of that thing in any way. Well, since we've got you on the line, I'll tell you, we used to have folks come on from the Daily Kingfish periodically, like we have so many of other state blogs, but we hadn't had a guest come on in a while. We've kind of lost some of our contacts. I believe the blog has gone through some new folks. So we're going to ask you then real quickly about Louisiana and down ballot or congressional races. Are there any that are ones we should watch?
There are a few. In Louisiana, we have currently a 5-1 Republican delegation, and that's not likely to change anytime soon. But there are some races that are pretty crazy down here, as you might expect for Louisiana. In the 5th district, that's in northern Louisiana, based around Monroe and Alexandria, we have Republican Congressman Vance McAllister. And McAllister unexpectedly won a special election in 2013 against the establishment-favored Republican. But McAllister was caught on camera making out with a staffer who was not his wife. And that put him in some danger. And at the moment, we have McAllister being challenged by several Republicans and one Democrat. The good thing for McAllister is, since there are so many Republicans running and there's only one Democrat running, there's a good chance that Democrats going to slide through to the runoff. It's very likely we're going to have a runoff and nobody's going to get 50% in November. So it's likely that the Democrat is going to make it to the runoff. And if you're McAllister, that's very good news, because if you can join him in there, if you can make it to the runoff with a Democrat, you're probably going to win in this district. Romney did very well up in northern Louisiana, and while Landrieu is going to need to do pretty well here, she's unlikely to outright win it. And for McAllister, if he can make sure he gets just enough votes to get second or first in November, and he can take on Democrat Jamie Mayo in December, that's really good for him. It gives him a very good shot to return to Congress. The other House race to watch is in the Baton Rouge area. It's to replace Cassidy. And it's also a very heavily Republican district, and we have a host of Republicans running. But the Democrat running is somebody very familiar, former Governor Edwin Edwards. He just got out of prison a few years ago, and he's trying to return to the House after a 50-year absence, in fact. And Edwards is somebody who in Louisiana really needs no introduction. Everybody has an opinion about Edwin Edwards one way or the other. So the Republicans he's facing, not nearly as well known. And this is another race where we're probably going to have a runoff between Edwin Edwards and some Republican. The big issue is this is such a Republican district. This Romney won close to 2/3, if not more, here, that Edwards is going to have a tough time winning in December. He does have a unique appeal, and he is a bit of a wild card, but it's a lot to ask voters to not only vote for a Democrat, but to also vote for a guy who is not only an ex-con, but he's 84 years old and isn't going to be serving very long.
Yes, unique appeal, very, very creative phrase for the person who in the last, decade has been both through prison and had his own reality show. What happened to that reality show? It came on, but I don't think it really made it, if you will. I don't know if they finished the season, did they?
I think one episode aired, and they couldn't unload the rest of them fast enough. It just – nobody watched it as far as I can tell, and very few people liked it. It just didn't seem to go very far. So Edwin's back in the news anyway, though, so good for him.
Yeah, he has a strange way of making things happen, if you will. I've a video or DVD that I found somewhere called Louisiana Boys, and it was about the history of Louisiana politics, and it was produced, I want to say, like in the early 90s, and it showed
old historical footage of Eddie Edwards. I mean, this guy has been around, you know, for so long in Louisiana politics, and really it's probably time for somebody new, but I guess nobody's willing to step up. And it's real interesting, you know, in those congressional districts, you had the Molossoff seat down in the bayou, if you will, that has been Democratic. You had Don Cashew, who won that special election in that Baton Rouge-based district. And, of course, Cedric Richmond, still the congressman in New Orleans. I mean, you had three seats out of your delegation Democratic, and now it just sounds like those seats won't come back unless something drastic happens. Did the Republicans redistrict, or did politics just shift that much in Louisiana?
Probably a combination of both. The Republicans definitely worked hard to redistrict the state. They have to eliminate, at the time of redistricting, the Republicans controlled the process, and there were six Republican districts and one Democratic district, and they had to eliminate one. And because of the Voting Rights Act, they couldn't eliminate the one Democratic African-American district. So they did the next best thing and threw as many African-Americans as possible into the district. And so that Baton Rouge sheet that Edwards is running in its previous form, it was possible for a Democrat to win. Don Cashew did win it for a little while, but they basically removed Baton Rouge's African-American areas and put them in the second district where Cedric Richmond is. So that district is much whiter and much redder. But you also do have, at the same time, Louisiana was trending Republican. People like Melanchthon could still win for a while, and you do still have a lot of Democrats in the state legislature who represent conservative districts, but you have seen the state legislature over the last few years especially, where Democrats are either retiring or switching parties, and Republicans are also replacing them.
Yeah, I just I happen to work in both of those races, you know, as a political consultant, Cashew and Molossaw, and so I was just really surprised how quickly things had changed, even though I was several hundred miles away after the fact. Well, let's continue to move to the South. Jeff, we had you on for, you know, national stuff, but we did found this unique Louisiana connection. We had to take advantage of it. But, Catherine, you just pick where we go next. It's like a southern vacation, Catherine. You just pick. You can come back home. You can go to North Carolina, Arkansas, Kentucky, you name it.
I want to go to Kentucky. I like Kentucky. And I'm curious. This race, this Senate race in Kentucky is just, you know, curiouser and curiouser. so it looks like Allison is, or I should say Mitch McConnell is sort of solidifying his lead. But it also looks like that could change. I mean, it seems like it's sort of flip-flopping. I mean, we look at the map of the United States, and there's so many toss-ups, and so many in the South. So it's what do you think about Kentucky?
Kentucky is a hard one to sort of gauge. You have the Republican minority leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who's not at all popular in Kentucky. He's overstayed his welcome, and I think David Neer said a few months ago when he was on the show, if this was almost any other state, McConnell would be gone right now. But it's Kentucky. It's a state that does have a Democratic tradition and still has many powerful Democrats in office, but it definitely does not like Obama. It's really turned against national Democrats in recent cycles. And McConnell is doing his best to tie Democrat Allison Grimes to the Obama administration. Basically, all his dads or his allies' dads are saying, Obama hates coal. Obama hates your jobs. Grimes likes Obama. You have to hate Grimes. That's a little simplified, but that's basically what they're trying to do. And Grimes herself, she's very supportive of the coal industry. But if Republicans can make the argument, a vote for Grimes is a vote against coal, that's very hard to counter. But in the last few weeks, we've seen some pretty bad polls for Grimes. Some have shown – they've pretty consistently shut her down, some by maybe 4 points, others by 8. And this race isn't over. Both parties are still spending big, and Grimes recently released an internal poll from a very respected Democratic pollster that showed her up 1 point. So Democrats are definitely still taking this seriously, and beating McConnell, Democrats would be elated to beat McConnell.
That would be sweet.
Oh, yes. I've heard some Democrats privately say that they don't want this outcome to happen, but they think it would be pretty hilarious if the Republicans took the Senate, but McConnell lost anyway. But not something that they want, but it would be pretty ironic. But
yes.
But still, Grimes is a very good candidate, but getting her over that last hump is pretty difficult in a state that where the undecided voters don't like McConnell, but they also don't like Obama.
Well, I don't really want to move this beyond the individual states, but I just want to comment on that. I think these races are really all about turnout at this point,
mm-hmm.
right? And do we see a lot of Democratic money or progressive money being spent in Kentucky for GOTV and voter registration? I mean, I know there's a lot going on in Georgia. I think there's quite a bit going on in Arkansas. Are we seeing that kind of activity in Kentucky as well?
I haven't heard one way or the other, but I would be shocked if Democrats weren't focusing on turnout here. And I know that when the Affordable Care Act started being implemented and we have the Connect program in Kentucky, their version of Obamacare, which has been very popular, that part of voter registration has sort of gone hand in hand with that. And getting people who were not insured until now registered, that's a really good thing to happen. Not just civically, but they're the ones who benefit from the Obama administration. Hopefully they'll remember that in November.
Okay, I'm sorry. We can switch back to the individual states. I just wanted to comment on that. David, you want to pick the next one?
Well, just going back onto Kentucky real quick, or staying with it, it seems like if the Democrats could make the race about likability, Alison London Grimes just is a likable person, and not saying that's the way we should elect candidates, would win this race pretty handily. Do you get that sense? And how could the Democratic Party or Kentucky Democrats or whatever you have make this race about likability instead of about the president's approval rating?
That's the million-dollar question in Kentucky and pretty much in all of the South. It's hard to say. They might want to try more to make it less about Grimes' likability, although that is still important, and more about McConnell's unlikability. At the moment, neither McConnell or Obama is popular, but among voters who don't like either of them, it's a lot to ask for voters who hate Obama but hate McConnell to still vote for Grimes, because they might still see McConnell as a good way to counter the president. So we have to find a way to make them say, I don't like either of them, but I really hate this McConnell guy and vote against him.
Yeah,
and McConnell
Go ahead.
Yeah, McConnell certainly makes it a lot easier than he might like. He's pretty condescending, and he's not really a likable person. So anything we could do there would be nice.
Yeah, it sounds like it's gotten to be where it really is not so much the individual candidates, it's so much the national party. We could put up a donkey and an elephant and say vote. That's probably oversimplifying it, but it seems like people are really not taking into consideration necessarily a lot of the individual characteristics of each candidate in each state.
That does happen. There are some exceptions, though. Nevada in 2010 is actually a good example. Another senior Senate leader was targeted and not popular in the state. That was Democratic leader Harry Reid then, and he was underwater, and Obama was underwater in the state, so you had all the makings for a Republican victory, but Reid greatly benefited by his Republican opponent, Sharon Angle, being pretty crazy. So, Nevada isn't Kentucky. Reid isn't McConnell. So you can't really just say, hey, it worked for one guy, it could work for the other, or, hey, it worked for Democrats then, it could work for Democrats now. But at the same time, in Nevada, you do have people say, I don't like Reid, I don't like Obama, but this person's much worse, so I'm going to hold my nose and vote for the candidate I don't like.
Or not vote.
Or not vote. And McConnell is probably hoping that happens for him, that voters. But at the same time, we could, if we can get McConnell's ratings down far enough, you could have Grimes defy political gravity and win there, like Reid did in 2010.
Yeah. Well, I know that's the one that if Democrats nationally, irregardless of state, you know, where they live, could pick one, just defeating the minority leader of the Republicans in the Senate would be very sweet, if you will. Well, let's continue to move around. Catherine, since I guess I'm trying to do my geography, North Carolina and Kentucky, I'm not sure they touch. I don't think they do, but they're – if we're taking a little vacation, that'd make a lot of sense. So we're probably going to skip over Virginia since Ed Gillespie seems to not be mounting much of a campaign. We'll go to that North Carolina race. And that's a race that has gotten a lot of polling. And probably part of that is that public policy polling is based in North Carolina. And so they understand the state really well. And they do a lot of polls on that state. Give us your sense of Kay Hagan and Tom Teals.
All right, so you have freshman Democratic Senator Kay Hagan. She was elected in the Democratic wave of 2008, and she started out this campaign not incredibly established in the state. That seems to be a recurring problem, actually, for North Carolina senators. They just don't seem to make that much of an impression on their voters, good or bad. And Republicans have spent millions to sabotage her, to paint her as another Obama vote, and North Carolina did vote for Obama in 2008 and got close to voting for him in 2012. So Democrats have a much higher floor in the state than they might in, say, Kentucky or West Virginia or Louisiana. But it's still – Obama's still not doing incredibly well nationwide, so it's fair to say he's not incredibly popular in the Tar Heel state. The advantage Kay Hagan does have, though, is Tom Tillis, her Republican opponent, is pretty unpopular himself. He's the Speaker of the House, and the state legislature in the last 2 years has passed some very unpopular policies. And just in this last session, they were engaged in a pretty long, long session that got lots of negative headlines. So Tillis himself is not exactly the Republicans' ideal candidate. And the last few public policy polling polls have shown Hagan's not popular at all, but Tillis, utterly hated. And it doesn't help that Tillis himself has been pretty undisciplined on the campaign trail. During their first Senate debate, Tillis made some pretty grave errors. He was pretty patronizing to Hagan. When she was kept on referring to him as Speaker Tillis, while he was just saying, well, Kay, pretty patronizingly. And at one point he suggested that she doesn't really understand budgets, which doesn't make any sense because she's a former bank vice president and she was the budget chair in North Carolina Senate. So he got plenty of negative headlines for just being a jerk. And if you want to go beyond that, sounding pretty sexist, actually. So this is a race where Tillis isn't as bad as a lot of the Republican candidates have been in the past, say Todd Akin or Sharon Engel, but he's might be his own worst enemy.
Yeah, I think you're right about being an undisciplined candidate because it's pretty well known that, if a candidate is going to a male candidate is going to debate a female candidate, they have to be very careful in how they present themselves and being respectful and not coming off that way. And then, of course, not thinking Chenderson's budgets when she has a finance background is pretty insulting as well. Well, let's continue to move around, but Catherine, I'm going to throw it back to Catherine. Kay, she any follow-up on North Carolina or wants to move to the next state?
Oh, I think we need to move to Georgia. What do you think about Georgia, Jeff?
Georgia's a hard one to put our finger on for both the governor and Senate race. You do have both Democratic candidates, Jason Carter for governor and Michelle Nunn for Senate. They're consistently doing pretty well in the polls. They may be leading or trailing by a little bit. The big problem is the runoff in Georgia. Like Louisiana, you need to get 50% or more in November, or else you advance to the runoff. The big problem in Georgia that we don't have in Louisiana is if both the governor and the Senate race go to runoff, they're on different days.
Oh, it's terrible.
The governor's race would be in December. The Senate race would be in January. So if one of them goes to runoff, that's hard enough to get our voters to show up again. Both of them, it's like pulling teeth. And Democrats historically have not been, especially in recent cycles, they haven't been as good about churning up to these irregularly scheduled elections as Republicans have been. So that's and if we have to do this twice, that's a big disadvantage we find ourselves in. And while in Louisiana, as I was talking a bit before, voters, they might be more accustomed to the idea of having to show up again a month later. In Georgia, that doesn't seem to be nearly as common, so it's a lot harder to get people to not only remember you have to show up in December, but you have to show up in December and you have to show up in January.
And it's just a whole bunch more money, too.
Yes, exactly.
And a long period, especially for the January runoff. You've got, like, you know, 2.5 months that you've got to have money for. It's really unfortunate that those two runoff dates.
Yeah, it's pretty terrible. And for none, you might have a similar problem that Landry might have. If control of the Senate comes down to that race, then Republicans are going to nationalize it, and that's going to be their benefit. Jason Carter won't have that same problem because the governor's race in Georgia isn't going to affect anything directly outside the state. But even so, it's going to be difficult. So their challenge isn't just to get more votes from the Republican opponents, but to get to 50% plus one.
Yeah, I do think one thing that Jason Carter has going for him is that a lot of people that are maybe more apt to vote Republican have started to see Nathan Dill in a very negative light. There was a story that came out on Friday. It was, I guess, on the front page of the Saturday Atlanta Constitution that he fired two directors on the health board. And I probably oversimplifying that name. And the nursing home commission, if you will, the people that run nursing homes wanted a rate hike. It was declined, and then he put two people out, and he says it's coincidental that it wasn't him just trying to tote the water of the nursing home directors community. And it's just been a long line of these kind of things that have come out on him, and people have started to kind of see him as maybe not so honest. I won't use uglier terms that have been used elsewhere, probably even by myself on the show. But I get the sense that that's happening, and that's going to help Jason Carter, even though, surprisingly, the polls of the Senate and the governor's race have started to match more, because for a while it had been where Jason Carter would either be leading or be down by a little, and, you know, Michelle Nunn would be down by more, and it seemed like he was doing definitely better. Now they've started to kind of sync up a little more, and so that'd be interesting to see. On Friday, three polls came out from three different organizations, and much has been made of, you know, where does each poll peg the African-American vote as a percentage of the electorate? Where does, you know, how many white voters will vote for the Democratic candidate? That's another big factor. And I've kind of got a formula. Back when I played high school football, I didn't play secondary, but I remember the secondary call. They would play cover three, and they'd say, thirds, thirds. And they'd yell it out. I think that's all we ever played. It was thirds, thirds. And that's kind of how I see this election, in that if a third of the electorate is African-American and the Democratic candidate could get a third of the white vote, it's a done deal. The Democratic candidate would win without a runoff. Now, that being said, I don't think the African-American electorate will get to 30. I think it may get to 29, but it won't get to 30. And then, and when I say thirds, I should say 30, not 33. And then secondly, I also don't think we'll get to 30% of the white vote, but I do see some of these polls that are showing us getting 24 and 25 as opposed to the 20 and 21 that was pretty much speculated for Roy Barnes in 2010. So those are, to me, the two numbers when you look at any poll. If you can figure out where that is, you've got a decent – a look at this race. Jeff, what's your thought on those, you know, key numbers?
As far as African-American turnout goes, I think in 2010, which was pretty much a low point for Democrats everywhere, turnout for African-Americans was about, I want to say about 28% of the electorate, and I believe in 2012 it was about 30. I might be a little off on both of those, but the idea is it did move up in 2012 when Obama was on the ballot, but it didn't, and that definitely could make the difference in a close race, but it wasn't an overall sea change. So this is going to be a game of inches, but we have a good starting point for 28%, and if we could just get it a little bit higher, just a little higher, that's really good. As for getting to the 30% of the white vote, I believe that's what Nunn and Carter are aiming for. They're trying to exceed it, but I think they believe that if they can get to that 30% for African Americans or so and 30% among white voters, that's enough for a narrow win. And both those are going to be difficult, but they are doable, I believe.
Well, you know, there is a lot of activity in Georgia with, you know, we have a state table, and they're doing a lot for GOTV and registration. And then getting a lot of attention, you know, getting, you know, Michelle Obama was here on Monday, and she, you know, riled up the masses about, you know, bringing, you know, if you're going to vote, take someone with you that will vote with you. I think there's a lot of messaging about voting and about early. And now we have Souls to the Polls. It was just announced this week that both DeKalb and Fulton County will have Sunday voting. Actually, Fulton's going to have two Sundays of voting. DeKalb County, those are both metro Atlanta counties. Well, Fulton is predominantly Atlanta. We're going to have Sunday voting on two Sundays in Fulton. So I think those kind of initiatives by these counties is going to help, and it gives us more opportunity to message and more opportunity to rally people to the polls. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. It's just a matter of, you know, moving those bodies and getting them to the polls.
Exactly. And one bit of untapped potential for Democrats is the state's growing Latino population. It's small, but it's been growing, and that's been one of the big reasons why Georgia's looking a lot more appealing for Democrats this year than it has in the last few. And getting Latino voters out who haven't shown up in the past, that's going to be critical. And it's going to be difficult, but it's something that Democrats need to do, and it could very well make the difference.
Yeah, I think all those pieces have to be there, but it's not going to be just one strategy, as I think it's been in a lot of states in the past. They're trying to see to push, you know, different angles, if you will. And I think you're right. I noticed that a commercial that they seem to run ad nauseum. I was at a restaurant. They had the CBS local telecast of the news, and the Republicans. It seemed like the same three commercials played. It was a pro Jason Carter ad from his campaign, a Michelle Nunn ad that didn't even, I can't even remember what it was, and then a negative ad that was from an outside group that had the, you know, the picture with her and, you know, Senator or President Obama side by side. And so that seems to be a common angle across the nation, if you will. Well, Catherine, we've still got more southern states to look at. Move us to another one.
Let's go to Arkansas.
All right.
That was on our list, right? I think Arkansas was on our list.
We have that one and a few more, yeah.
Okay. So Arkansas is another state where we have a competitive governor's race and a competitive Senate race. For governor, we have an open seat race where Democrat Mike Ross, a former congressman, is trying to defend the seat against Republican Asa Hutchinson. He's another former congressman, and he was the 2006 nominee. And for Senate, we have Democrat Mark Pryor is trying to win re-election against Republican Congressman Tom Cotton. And so far, both races have been competitive. Both parties are spending big here, but the Senate race seems to be going a bit better for Democrats. Pryor and Cotton are polling very close, and in the last few polls, unfortunately, Cotton has been leading, but Pryor has released an internal showing him up to. But in the governor's race, you consistently see Hutchinson is polling ahead of Cotton, and he's consistently ahead by mid to high single digits. And that's a little bit different than what a lot of people might have expected, actually, because Democratic Governor Mike Beebe, he's departing office, he's insanely popular. He might be the most popular. He might be the most popular person in Arkansas, including Bill Clinton. And I think him being there would make it easier to argue, give the Democrats 4 more years in the governorship. But maybe it is helping, but so far not enough.
And there's there is a lot of groups spending money there, right? I think I saw that you noted that Planned Parenthood is spending a lot of money there, and I mean there seems to be quite a bit of attention. So hopefully that will help.
Both parties are spending a lot of money in both races, but the Senate race is definitely taking priority. It's closer, and the stakes are bigger nationally, so they're going to spend a lot there. And basically, I wouldn't want to be an Arkansas voter right now because you're never going to be able to – you're not going to be able to watch television live without seeing about 30 commercials for the next month or so.
And forget about answering the phone.
Oh, yes.
Yes, robocalls haven't started here yet, at least for me. Maybe I'm in the wrong profile, if you will, but I'm sure they'll start soon because even though I use a cell phone, I know those numbers are getting more out there. Well, Jeff, let me ask you something. In 2002, Mark Pryor won election in one of the worst Democratic years, probably in elective history, if you will. 94 is up there, and then you could probably go back to some other ones well in the past. But, 2002 was just horrible. And Mark Pryor won, and he won, not by a huge margin, but it wasn't a squeaker either. It wasn't, up all night to win by, a recount percentage. Then in 2008, he was so popular, the Republicans couldn't even really field a candidate against him. And it was like a no race. And now he's in this tight election. And I know Arkansas is like a lot of other states. It's not as Democratic as it used to be. But it hadn't changed that much since 2008, certainly. Like you said, they still got a very popular Democratic governor, so they hadn't given up on Democrats altogether by any means. What's happened to Mark Pryor?
The big thing that's happened to Mark Pryor is he has some votes that can be tied back to an unpopular Democratic president that wasn't an issue in 2002, and it wasn't an issue in 2008 when Bush was president and really unpopular. It's an issue now. Pryor has voted for Obamacare, and that was the right thing to do, but it's going to haunt him. He also has some other votes or statements or pictures in the proximity of Obama that they can use against him. And you actually saw this happening with Bush to a lot of Northern Republicans. They managed to get away with re-election for quite a while until Bush was unpopular and they were up, and that was it for many of them. I think that the same thing's happened to a lot of Southern Democrats in 2010 or now. When Bush was president, they could vote against him, and people cared a lot less. People seem to care a lot less if you vote against a president that they like than if you vote with a president that they hate. And I think that's a big reason why Pryor's in big trouble right now.
Yeah, well, I know that he did vote for Obamacare, but one thing Mark Pryor's actually done is he's actually tried to run some ads pro-Obamacare. Ads that go, Obamacare, good for you. I mean, it's talking about specifics where you can't be, lose your health insurance for pre-existing conditions and certain aspects of the law that people really like. But I think that's the right strategy. Have y'all seen any polling or movement to show that that strategy is helping him, or is it really not having an effect?
It might be too early to say if it's been having an effect one way or the other. I think it's a good strategy, too. Democrats have been trying that a bit. Mark Begich up in Alaska, he's run quite a few of those ads saying, I'm helping fight the insurance industry. And some other Democrats have tried that, and it's the right move. A lot of voters just don't pay enough attention and don't realize he's talking about Obamacare. They might just think, oh, he's fighting the insurance industry. That's great. I like this. And Republicans have been running counter ads saying that thing he was talking about, Obamacare. But everybody knows at this point he voted for Obamacare. The Republicans are going to keep reminding him, but I think that part might be baked in already. I think people have decided whether they are going to hold that against him or not. But it's going to be very interesting to see that if to see if highlighting the individual parts of Obamacare that are very popular is going to work. And Pryor and Begichuk in Alaska and quite a few of them are going to be good test cases.
Yeah. Now, one thing I will say that I think could be possibly part of the reason Mark Pryor's having more trouble, in 2002, once again, I worked in the campaign, put the campaign ads on the website, so I watched all of them. Actually, back then, you had to they'd ship you or sometimes they'd send you files, but sometimes they'd even ship you VHSs and you had to or DVDs,
wow.
And you had to actually transfer them. I remember that, and then it wasn't just like a year or two later. All that nonsense had stopped, and you could get them emailed to you and whatnot. But one of those ads, actually more than one of those ads, there's one about him overcoming cancer, and his wife at the time, ex-wife now Jill, starred in it, Jill Pryor. Another one who's talking about fiscal responsibility, and she called him cheap, and he would say, oh, I'm frugal, I'm wise, oh, you're cheap. It was a cute ad. But both of those ads, she starred in it. And now she's not starring in the movie anymore, if you will, in the sequel. Do you think that that's somehow is part of the reason he's not doing as well? It's not so much, we've seen, you know, politicians get divorced and all that kind of thing, and it happens. But the fact that he built a lot of his campaign around him early on in his political career, you know, as a team kind of with his wife, and now the team split up, you know, the band broke up, could that be an impact?
That's an interesting thing. I not really thought about that. I'm not sure. I mean, messy divorces definitely can hurt politicians. Pryor got elected by beating the Republican senator at the time, Tim Hutchinson, who had some big divorce problems, but I'm not really sure. I think he would, in a perfect world, he would like to have his wife or another sympathetic figure starring in his ads, and that can definitely make a difference in a close race, but I'm not sure. If Pryor narrowly loses, I think maybe we could argue that if he had his wife or somebody else in those ads, it could have made the difference, but I don't think it's going to make enough of a difference outside of a very, very close race. But that is something I definitely want to think about.
Yeah. Catherine, before we move to that, and actually I'm going to let you move to the next state after you answer my question, what are your thoughts on that theory that the divorce may hurt him? And then you, from there, move us to the next state.
Well, I think that I don't know the circumstances surrounding his divorce, so I don't know if it was ugly and if it was public and all that. I do think that we tend to prefer candidates who have supportive and dynamic spouses. I think we've seen that in presidential races, certainly in governor's races, where, you know, if you have an invisible spouse who's doesn't appear in ads or doesn't make a appearance on the campaign trail, we tend to I'm not agreeing with this. I think it's false and kind of ridiculous, but I think we just sort of idealize this whole idea of a happy family living in the governor's mansion or, you know, being in Washington and hosting parties and being, you know, I think we tend to prefer that. So I think it might have an impact. Whether it does for Pryor this time, it's hard, like Jeff said, it's hard to know all the things that go into what makes people vote or not vote. You know, I mean, I think it may affect a small percentage of people. It may just be a question of comfort with a candidate, and you can't really gauge that always. So that's not really an answer, but that's sort of how I feel about it. And I guess next, where have we not gone?
Well, Florida, obvious with the governor's race, and then we might squeeze in South Carolina. But Buckland's been on the show recently, so if we don't get back to South Carolina, I think we're okay.
So on to Florida. I just saw a new poll that Crist is ahead now. Is that right? Did I read that right?
Yeah, there have been a few new polls, but a new independent one from Public Policy Polling, they did show him up by about 3 points or 3 or 4 points, I believe. And you have seen a few Republican pollsters that have shown him Rick Scott, the Republican, up by a few points. So it still looks like it's on a nice edge. The Republicans spent tons and tons of money over the summer against Charlie Crist. Rick Scott has a bank account basically the size of the state. He can afford to spend as much as he wants, while Charlie Crist can't. And the good news is they spent so much money and Crist is still standing. He's at worst down only a few points, and at best he might even be up a few after that giant ad blitz. And Democrats now are starting to spend money to, if not equal to Republicans, at least have enough to have a good air presence. And it's quite possible that in Florida, the state might just be so polarized that neither candidate can really move too far. Both candidates are very, very well known, and people have pretty much decided whether they like or hate them by now. But every little bit helps, and the fact that Chris is able to survive this long when everything was against him is a really good sign.
Yeah, I was surprised to see that, because I thought we had sort of, I mean, I don't know. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Catherine, I think you're right to be surprised. The fact that we saw poll come out in Pennsylvania, and we're not going to actually delve into that race, but the governor there is not really popular at all, probably almost as unpopular as we heard Rick Scott was, yet Rick Scott's doing better, and I think that tells you Florida still has a little bit of a southern feel to it, and there's still a lot of Republicans that just aren't going to switch over like Pennsylvania independents or soft Republicans might. And so I think that may be why Rick Scott has been able to be competitive, whereas everything we heard early on in his term, this guy was going to be a one-termer because he just made all the wrong moves, if you will. But that's my take on it. Well, Jeff, we sure to appreciate you being on the Kudzu Vine tonight. Before you go, and we close out tonight, tell us if there's anything we should be looking to read in the next week or two or even further out on Daily Kos Elections from you.
Okay. There is some good stuff we're going to be rolling out in the next few days. We're going – that President ILD project I was talking about where we calculate the results of the presidential race by state legislative district. We're going to have some new interactive maps out for South Carolina and Georgia tomorrow. It'll show you how each district voted and who sits there, so you can see what districts in South Carolina or Georgia may have voted for Romney but send a Democrat to the Capitol or vice versa. And we're also going to roll out the data and the maps for Louisiana and Arkansas next week. And we're going to have some other states outside the South for those. But those are the ones I'm really looking forward to, especially Louisiana.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, it was not wrong. You did a good job for us. And I tell you what, we're definitely going to have you back, if nothing else, to talk about this project, maybe after the election and we've decompressed that. We may have to have you back sooner, of course, to talk about these races. But when we're, you know, not in the throes of election 2014, to really get a sense of some of this data at the legislative level. Sound good?
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing how things shake out in 2014 and seeing where some of these districts go. I think we're going to have a lot of stuff to process.
Yeah, we didn't even know about this, Catherine. We booked Jeff, but then he gave us this whole new interesting facet to his political knowledge base.
Well, this is something that we're doing, too. We're, you know, all the work that's being done on the ground is looking at these Obama performance numbers and, you know, making some judgments about races that have potential based on those numbers. So I'm glad to hear that other states will have that data available, and that, because I think it's very important, this kind of database calculations, because we don't have endless amounts of money, so we have to use it carefully. And so when we look at these performance numbers, it gives us a much better I mean, we can't, obviously we can't predict exactly what's going to happen, but we can use those numbers to give us a better sense of what might happen in those districts.
Yeah,
so
definitely.
I'm excited.
Yeah, it's been really great, and we've learned quite a lot about a lot of these states.
All right. Well, Jeff, thanks again for being on the Kudzu Vine, and that's pretty much our hour, so we're going to close it down for September 14th.
Good night, everybody. Thanks again, Jeff.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.
Thanks, Kim. Good night.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.